Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. This is a very special show. We have three guests today, and they're here because something special has happened. All of you know who listen to Bookworm on any regular basis that this bookworm is a lover of literature at its finest, which often means rarest, hardest to find. And the publishers of small presses, literary presses, as we now call them, small presses as they were known in the 60s, are coming together in Los Angeles, nine of them, to talk about the fate of the literary press. It's threatened on every side by the demise of the NEA, by the disappearance of foundation funding, except for a very few treasured set of funders. And it's about joining an amalgamation of literary presses to ensure the future of the literature that true readers care most about, that is to say, the development of the new writer, the cherishing of the difficult work, the preservation of traditions within literature that really amount to our culture. My guests today are John O'Brien, publisher of Dalkey Archive Press from Normal, Illinois; Betsy Lucian, executive director of the Coffee House Press in Minneapolis; and Robert McDowell, executive director of the Storyline Press from Oregon. Now, let's begin with the immediate circumstance. John, what brought you here this weekend?
Nine of the larger small presses gathered in Los Angeles to try to face the problem of what's going to be the future of literary presses. Funding has come to an end for most of the few foundations that have been supporting all of us. At the same time, we're facing a number of problems with bookstores, rates of returns. So over the last 6 years, a number of us have become large, according to the usual standards of literary presses. But we all face the problem now of perhaps going back to our basements, back to our garages, as a way of continuing what it is we're doing. So for the last few days, we've been meeting to talk about what the future is going to be, how we're going to face it, and how we can collaborate with each other to be able to continue what we've been doing for the last 10 years, 15 years.
Well, Betsy, why should a listener, even a listener to a literary show, why should a person care what happens to the small presses in America?
Well, that's a very good question, because some of the listeners might be asking themselves, what in fact is a nonprofit literary publisher? Why do they exist? And the fact of the matter is, there are probably more than 10,000 literary writers, literary artists out there that would not have been published without the existence of nonprofit presses. We publish the writers, the contemporary writers in general, that the commercial publishers won't touch because of their styles, because of their literary styles, because they won't make money off of these literary artists, because it's a little bit too different in terms of a writing genre. But without literary publishers, a number of literary writers would not get published, period, end of story.
I want to interrupt here and say that my own take on this situation is much more dire than Betsy's. My feeling as a bookworm is that by and large most of the commercial presses are not touching not hard to understand writers. They are turning their backs on fiction and poetry of a serious sort altogether. That if a book can, say, like a John Irving book, capture a mass imagination, yes, a certain kind of literary fiction will still be there. But by and large, a book that lives in the mind and stays alive for years and years afterwards, these are books that they don't know what to do with anymore. These are corporate people, and they are doing to the publishing of literature what the movie conglomerates did to American movies, that is to say, remove the art. Robert McDowell is my third guest, and I wanted to begin by asking you, what is the mission of Storyline Press, your press?
Well, as the name implies, Storyline Press is committed to to preserving all aspects of story in our culture. It is committed to the resurgence of narrative or storytelling in contemporary poetry, to new experiments in revival in form in poetry, and it is also committed to serious community outreach projects, particularly with a focus in rural areas.
Well, the reason I wanted to bring that up immediately is that people who listen say, well, I don't like that experimental literature, but what you're hearing is that this is a conglomerate that embraces all sorts of aspects of literature. Many of my listeners who call me up and ask me, why don't poets rhyme anymore? Well, the answer to that question can in part be answered that they do, that if you know the books from Storyline Press, you might discover a healthy life for the villanelle. On the other hand, John O'Brien publishes books from all ages that have been traditionally wild. This is the non-conservative side of literary publishing.
Well, Michael, a lot of this goes back to what the history of publishing is. Starting in about the middle of the last century, books could make money, they could reach a large audience, and for the last 100 years they were a source of a lot of income to a number of people. In the United States, starting in 1900, we had people like Alfred A. Knopf, Horace Liveright, starting publishing companies that were driven by their own visions. And those companies continue in some form. The names of the companies continue. Most of our great writers, both from this country and from other countries, were published by these people. We're now into the third generation of those companies. They are owned by conglomerates. They're there as a business to make a profit. I don't really have any arguments with commercial publishing. They do some wonderful writers. They have no commitment to keeping these writers in print. They have no commitment to taking risks. They have no commitment to serving the public in any other way than giving the public what they think the public wants and what the public's willing to buy. It continues. It staggers on. But it's obvious with poetry especially that it's no longer being done by commercial publishing. That's fallen to the small presses, did so 20 years ago. What we're facing now is that translations have more or less fallen to the small presses, and so has most of experimental fiction fallen to the small presses. The experimental is what Dahlke Archive specializes in.
Now, Betsy comes from a press in Minneapolis and is, in a certain way, that press I think of as being a kind of Heartland Press, in that they will both publish the upcoming selected poems of Kenward Elmslie, one of my favorite living poets, but they've also done letterpress editions of writers like Jane Smiley and writers who have had a certain kind of centrist interest in America. What is it that is the mission of Coffee House Press, Betsy?
Well, Coffee House is, in a lot of respects, similar to Dahlke. I mean, we do a lot of experimental fiction. A lot of what we publish essentially is fiction and poetry in terms of the trade books. But our mission is to represent essentially what may be described as some of the cutting edge, offbeat literary outsiders. The name Coffee House Press comes from the coffee houses of the old days, where the idea was that innumerable numbers of ideas, thoughts, could be had by the entire public, discussion of those ideas, so that there is no idea that is left out. And that's kind of what Coffee House Press does. We don't want to leave out any ideas. Something that we've become known for, I guess, in the recent past is we were kind of multicultural before the word existed, and we take that commitment seriously to represent the underrepresented. A lot of ethnic varieties are represented in our writing, as are a lot of women. Over 50% of our backlist represents works done by women. We have over 11 books by Asian American writers, 5 by African American. We've got Caribbean writers. We've got Puerto Rican poets and fiction. So it's a huge cross-section of ideas, of literary genres, A to Z. And that's what we like to see.
Now, before I bring up the immediate tragedy that brings the editors and publishers of 9 small presses to Los Angeles to create an umbrella organization, let me first ask you the impossible question. Are you saying to me that you guys don't want to publish a book that would be popular and makes money? You don't have the dream of an overnight success or something that carries the press into profit? Explain what a nonprofit press is.
The only motive, I think, for all of us is to publish quality. It's not to make a profit. It's not even necessarily to reach the largest possible audience. It's to serve an audience, to serve readers who are serious about reading, who cannot find the kinds of poetry fiction that's published by us coming from commercial publishers. If that were to happen, that we published a book that sold 500,000 copies, if it maintained the high standards that all of us set for our books, that's terrific. It might also create such problems for us, given our current circumstances, that we might not be able to handle that book. But it is not our motive to publish that kind of book. If it were handed to us and didn't fit the standards that we set for ourselves, we wouldn't publish it. If that same book were handed to a commercial house and they knew it was going to sell 500,000 copies, there wouldn't be any question of whether it, how good is it, is it the kind of book we represent. Well, that's the kind of business that we are in. It's quality, and we know that quality frequently is going to take a long time to reach the right people.
In other words, these are the books that stand the chance of being the classics of our literature and of world literature. And the point here that I want to bring up is that on the one hand, I'm going to name some cases. Dalkey Archive Press published a book that had been forgotten, Locos, it was called. It was barely known at all and became a bestseller and was reprinted by a commercial house, by Vintage. Storyline Press is publishing consistently the work of the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Louis Simpson. They've published his memoirs, they're publishing his translations and his new books of poetry. This is as mainstream an American poet as one expects to find. He's of the generation that gave us Robert Bly and James Wright. In other words, you have to understand, if you're listening to this, that you can no longer expect the so-called New York houses to be publishing the nation's best literature. And in many cases, the books that we all know are books that have been reviled in their own times. Jude the Obscure was so misunderstood that it caused Thomas Hardy to stop writing novels. There's an edition, beautifully done, of Jude the Obscure from another of these small presses, Sun and Moon. It's not that there is no Jude the Obscure out there. It's that Jude the Obscure needs to be maintained as part of the radical tradition it really is in. Now, you all had shared in a very unusual grant circumstance from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Robert McNeil of Storyline Press, can you tell me what that grant had been that has now come to an end and brought you all here?
The Mellon Foundation saw an opportunity, or created an opportunity, actually, to come into the field of literature, which they considered to be classically underfunded, to come in with significant financial support and services, to see if over a period of years they could bring test cases, the 9 presses involved, up to a level that would rejuvenate the literary field, and attract other major funders to come into the field, following, i.e., the example of Mellon.
So in other words, the Mellon grant has come to an end. I might point out that one of the reasons that its efforts to stimulate additional funding failed is that most of the grant organizations in America, with some notable and wonderful exceptions, are conservative organizations who have run away afraid of literature as a result of the criticism addressed to the NEA. Most of the public foundations are afraid of publishing work that is, so to speak, at the frontier of literature. People do not understand frequently why we need to inhabit those frontiers, why we need to inhabit them imaginatively as opposed to physically. People have a terrible confusion about the difference between artistic expression and violent public expression. And these are things, really, that you cannot live and have a culture without. I frequently say it on the air, there is no culture without altruism.
Michael, I think it's been more of a problem of foundations simply not knowing about these presses. And it's not just foundations. It's individuals who fund the other arts also aren't aware of the needs over in literature. And frequently these can be people who majored in English in college, love literature, and what money they give to the arts goes to museums and theaters. They're simply unaware. And that's been one of the problems of the nonprofit press area. It hasn't been good at announcing itself and making itself well known. Historically, if you look at nonprofit publishing, it really came on the scene after the existence of NEA. It was the first time there was any public money available to publishing. So we're looking at a very young field in comparison to art museums, symphony orchestras, even nonprofit theaters. A parallel to what's been going on with nonprofit publishing is that of nonprofit theaters. In the city of Chicago in the 1970s, there was one commercial theater open. One theater in the entire city, which used to be a very thriving place to be doing theater. Since the 1970s, there's still one commercial theater in Chicago. There's something in the range of 30 to 40 nonprofit and generally thriving theaters. That came about because of the support of philanthropy for nonprofit theater.
Robert McDowell, would you mind telling us the nine presses who came to Los Angeles to begin to discuss their common plight?
Well, the nine presses were, besides the three gathered here, Arte Publico, Copper Canyon, Gray Wolf Press, Milkweed Editions, Curbstone Press, and Sun and Moon Press here in Los Angeles.
With the addition of my three guests, John O'Brien of Dalkey Archive Press, Betsy Lucian of Coffee House Press, and Robert McDowell of Storyline Press. I just want to go around the table and name some of the names of the authors you've gotten from these presses, and I want to start out with Raymond Carver, who first came to attention from small literary press publications. Some other writers.
Donald Hall, Louis Simpson, Rita Dove, David Mason, Mark Jarman, Dana Gioia.
Well, we reprint a number of authors, Aldous Huxley, Flann O'Brien, Juna Barnes, Gertrude Stein. Among contemporaries, we've published Carol Meso, Ricky Ducournay, Gilbert Sorrentino, Nicholas Mosley.
Elaine Equi, Quincy Troop, Frank Chin, Karen Yamashita, Eileen True. We've got Andrei Kradruski way back when, and the list goes on. Colleen McElroy is somebody that we're publishing this spring.
So in other words, these are not what they used to call the maniac patrols. These are the authors that you come to know. Rita Dove was our poet laureate. We've got to be aware here that we're not talking about the outre. Now, listeners to National Public Radio are well aware of the concept that what you want when you want quality you are responsible for maintaining. So you have come together as editors and publishers to form a group which will do what, John?
One of its functions is to share a great deal of information among ourselves. We're all located, obviously, in different parts of the country. We all have undergone enormous amount of growth in the last few years. We've all had our problems and successes. So that's one of the purposes of it. Second purpose is to try to make the general public more aware of what we're doing. Third purpose is to make philanthropy aware of who we are, what we're doing, what function we have within the culture, and to try to seek the support of philanthropy for what we're doing.
But it is worth noticing that if you pick up literary magazines, every one of them now has in the back the invitation that asks you to become a contributor to the magazine. You are now the funders in many cases.
At this point, I think all of the presses, for example, involved in Literary Publishers Alliance, this new organization, have individual donor programs set up to help sustain their operations. And certainly we can provide any information about that to anyone who's interested. But beyond that, listeners, I hope, who hear this will be inspired, too, from the reader's point of view, inspired to stop a moment, take stock, reassess, and remember that they do have a certain responsibility also for keeping alive the best literature of our time, and to do what they can do, such as tangibly supporting these presses and presses like them in the future to further that goal, which I think we all share.
Well, to play the devil's advocate here, you know, and I think it's necessary too, because, you know, I face every day the question of, will what I love most live after I do? Do you know what I mean? A show like this is dedicated to the preservation of the literary work of art. And to some extent, this kind of show will preach to the converted. But the question becomes, why, if it won't maintain itself, should the work of art be protected? What is the preserver's impulse in a culture that seems to be negligent? Why do it?
I think it's on a level, Michael, of the assumption right now is that young people aren't interested in reading, which I don't think is true. In the book industry generally, publishers have never really kept track of who buys their books and how old are they. I don't think generally young people have been very well served by publishers. I think there is an audience, and I think there's a young audience out there. How large is it? It may not be any larger than it's ever been. Back in the 1940s, New Directions, which brought us Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams, estimated that there were about 40,000 very serious readers in the United States. That number may not be significantly different. The fact that New Directions published Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams caused us to change what we thought poetry was. It caused us to change what we thought America was. It caused us to reconceive of ourselves. The impact of that relatively small number of people, which is certainly much smaller than when you think of the audience for television, perhaps even the audience for PBS, it's a significant audience. And I think the way literature works is that it enters into a culture and begins to change things within the culture at large. And it stays around for a long time, and it finally shapes our idea of who we are. Try to imagine America without Melville, without Emerson, without Twain, without Hemingway. Our whole sense of who we are as individuals and as a society is generally has its roots in our literature.
And, you know, for people who think that that's a ridiculous concept, you have to remember that there was a time in living memory when most of Melville and most of James were unavailable, and it wasn't until Grove Press, really the smallest and most courageous of the New York presses, started publishing James and Melville. We didn't have them. It's possible not to have your best writers in print. Would you like to add to that, Robert?
Well, only to agree with it. I was thinking of, as John spoke, that I think in America we have a tendency to equate literature with entertainment. And I think it's a perilous road to go down. One might want to argue that literature is entertaining, so therefore, gee, start reading, it's fun. But I think that literature and the life of literature have much more to do with the things spiritual than with things entertaining. And perhaps it helps to think of it that way, and going back to what you had to say, Michael, about why work to preserve serious literature if the culture itself seems to be lax in some way.
Betsy?
Again, total agreement. And one of the examples, when you mentioned Melville, that comes to mind with us, for example, we have a writer that we're publishing the collected works of, Paul Metcalf, who was the great-grandson of Melville, and whose works have been out of print for a number of years, who we think is an incredible writer. Alan Kornblum, our publisher, said, we've got to do something about this. The New York publishers won't do it. And that is, when we're talking about nonprofit presses, again, something to keep in mind is we're not talking about organizations that have 50 employees. We're talking about organizations that have 6 to 8 employees, founded by people, generally speaking, 20 to 30 years ago, maybe even 10 to 15, who firmly believe in all the things that have been just said by not only Robert, by John, and by yourself, Michael. These are things that, this is an area that we need, just as we need every other art form, whether it be museums, whether it be dance, whether it be theater, music. It's the same thing.
In fact, you know, I want to point out that this is the direction that the arts are taking. That dance companies are forming umbrella organizations so that new projects, as they come along, can be applied for and funded by the umbrella organization, so that when someone has an important project, there's some place to go and make sure that it can be done, that it can be funded, that an act of imagination can be actualized. My guests today have been John O'Brien of Dalkey Archive Press, Betsy Lucian, the executive director of Coffee House Press, and Robert McDowell, the executive director of Storyline Press. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you,
Michael.
They have come together. They have formed LPA, the Literary Publishers Alliance. This is a brand new organization to ensure the future, really, of significant American literature. Thank you all for coming. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.